Welcome to Passing Years CAM Podcast, Conversations on Air Digestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Ed Bice, having a conversation on critical thinking for healthcare professionals.
Welcome to the ASHA 2021 podcast here in the Passing Years booth. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Kristen.
I have with me today Ed Bice, a speech-language pathologist specializing in a whole host of things. He has worked in all kinds of settings, medical settings. He's been a manager. He's worked with medical devices. Currently, you are at IOP. So tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into the topic, Ed.
Wow.
What do people need to know about you?
Rhymes, no. So I'm approaching 30 years as a medical speech pathologist. I did 10 years in the public schools before that.
People probably don't know that. Yeah.
So I've had a really diverse career. But 30 years in the medical area, mostly focusing on dysphagia, and that's coming up next year. So I've been doing it a little while.
Yeah. That is a long time.
So that's pretty exciting. And I think that one of the takeaways is I'm more passionate now than I've ever been. Every year I get more passionate about doing the best things for our patients that we possibly can do.
Well, one reason I ask you to do the podcast is because of your passion. Quite seriously. I mean, you are one of the most, you're probably one of the strongest advocates for speech-language pathologists and for the field of speech-language pathologists that I know.
Thank you.
And for people being on the top of their game and practicing at the top of their license, which is kind of what brought this whole topic up. Because what we're going to focus on, as you know, is critical thinking in speech-language pathology, the need for it, how people can develop that skill if they don't have it. What do we need in order to get everybody practicing at the top of their license, you know, really being the best clinician they can be. So let's first just start with what the actual problem is. Like, you know, what do we see going on in the field that maybe needs changing, maybe needs tweaking? You know, what's happening that's causing some of the issues with critical thinking?
Yeah, and I think we don't have to look very far to find the problem, right? I mean, social media is so prevalent now, and we can look at social media so easily and see thought processes or lack of thought processes really easily. And we can see that people come on social media not looking for concepts or not looking for information, but a quick answer. Tell me what I should, here's this patient, what should I do with them? And of course, there's so much information missing, and the human part that you and I don't see of the patient makes it almost impossible for us to answer those kinds of questions, because people are so much more complex than a blurb on Facebook. That we want to operate more like technicians than pathologists. We just want an answer. We don't want the why.
Personally, I think a part of the issue with that, and tell me what you think, is because of social media, because of cell phones, texting, all the access we have to quick answers, that it's kind of driving people to get used to that immediacy, that, you know, being able, like, we can Google immediately, you pull out your phone, Google an answer. And people are so used to that immediacy, I'm wondering if that's a part of the problem.
Oh, I would agree that's definitely part of the problem. I think the other part of the problem is that healthcare is not outcome driven. Healthcare is productivity, financially driven.
Oh, yes.
And so we're not looking for the best answer or to understand why. We're just looking to do something fast so we can get that productivity, so we can make our boss happy, so we can make the company happy. And but I also agree that, yeah, we live in an age of quick answers. And mm-hmm. So it's no different when we're talking about a very complex patient than it is when we're talking about what we're going to cook for dinner. You know, it's like we don't distinguish the difference between those two things.
And you mentioned the social media post and the immediacy of answers and all. And one of the things I've noticed in the ones I've responded to or that I see is people often do exactly what you said. I have a patient, what do I do? Like, I have a patient with a trach. Can they use a valve? And that'll be the whole question. And it's not, you know, they don't give, you don't know the age of the patient, the diagnosis of the patient, when they got a trach, are they on a vent or not on a vent, why they got it. You know, there's a bunch of missing information. So I want to kind of get at that. Like, you mentioned people are looking for the quick answer. And you mentioned they're not looking for the concepts.
The best analogy I can think is like math, right? So we start math by learning numbers, and then we learn to add is the very first thing that we learn how to do. And until you learn to add, you can't learn to multiply. And then you go on to algebra, but it all builds on itself. And I think that if you're going to be a thoughtful clinician, that everything has to build on itself. And we spend so much time memorizing facts rather than thinking about how things are interrelated. It's an educational system that starts at a very young age now, where kids are just learning to fill in bubbles to answer questions rather than actually connecting concepts. And so, you know, you don't just get a patient with dysphagia. So you have your dysphagia course, but your patient with dysphagia has respiratory issues, they have digestive issues, they have aphasia, they have cognitive issues, and it's all integrated. And we never take the time to integrate information. We're just memorizing facts and then moving on to get the grade. And that does not make us thoughtful people. And even in our clinical experience, because again, we work in a situation where it's all productivity driven and finance driven rather than outcome driven. Even when you go to your clinical placements, it's all still about checking boxes and moving on and checking boxes. And until we as a clinician step back and take a breath and take personal responsibility, I don't think the system is ever going to give that to us. We have to take control of it of ourselves. I did a piece for Dysphagia Cafe recently where I was just talking about foundational concepts.
Oh, you did? I saw that.
Yeah, and I looked at the curriculum of other therapist-like professions. Mm-hmm. And what I found when I looked at physical therapy is they have about 900 hours, if you count clock hours, of learning normal, basic, foundational information. Anatomy, physiology, how muscles work, what you can do to change muscles, you know, motor learning, exercise principles. They have all this underpinning before they get into, so here's what we do with our patients. And I think that that's a huge piece that's missing. We just jump in and start talking about what to do rather than this foundation of why. And whether you work in the public schools working on speech sound disorders, or whether you work in a hospital working with swallowing or some other area, if you have that foundational information, then you can start building on it and answering these why questions rather than just operating in a silo and doing mechanical behaviors.
Mm-hmm. And I've often said that if you don't know the normal, then you don't know what's abnormal. Like, you don't know what's atypical. You have to know that typical development or the normal movement of the muscle, or you may not see the abnormal movement because you don't know what to compare it to.
Right. And you know, yeah. And how, right. And how to influence that muscle to get it to do
right.
what you
and
want
then
it
you
to
get
do.
Into, yes. And then getting into treatment interventions.
I just participated in a dysphagia class at the University of Nevada, and we were talking about IOP, which I work for IOP, right, and how older patients had longer endurance than younger patients. And I asked the students, why would that be? Why would an older person have longer endurance than a younger person? And it has to do with sarcopenia and the muscle aging and type 2 muscles going away and being more susceptible to sarcopenia. And it was like, if you don't understand the mechanism that you're trying to treat and how it got here and why it is the way that it is, how do you develop a treatment plan? How do you think about this person? And I, you know, but again, when you have 90% productivity, does any of that matter?
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, and unfortunately, that is a barrier that a lot of clinicians face because there's so much focus on the productivity and they have to meet very high productivity standards, and they even have to sometimes are being pushed into picking up patients that may not be appropriate in order to meet that productivity. I just started asking, it's like, how do we get people to want to learn? Because you mentioned, and it's true, that underpinnings the foundation of critical thinking is having those that knowledge base, that foundational knowledge that drives all the different areas.
Stepping back and realizing all the things that you don't know and saying, so how do I begin to fill in these gaps? And rather than saying, I'm going to look for treatment approaches, like, for example, this past week, I just out of curiosity, went on Google Scholar and posted dysphagia treatment just to see what would come up. Literally, I think I found 2 since 2018 that weren't systematic reviews or meta-analyses of publications that already existed. And so if I'm really going to help my patients, I need to understand these basic principles. How does a muscle move? And how do I use that concept to get to evaluate a potential treatment. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. And when you start thinking about the chin tuck against resistance, and I know it's very popular because it's easy, you can see when people are doing it, and so I understand that that makes it very desirable. But the very foundational study on this was looking at SEMG signals. It wasn't looking at whether anything was happening at the level of the UES or laryngovestibule, and it's grown to now people recommend it for laryngovestibular closure and UES opening. And the only thing that that original study showed was that it had a greater SEMG signal. Well, the problem with that is when you push on an electrode, like using a ball, you're going to get a higher signal than when you're not pushing on it. If you think about what muscles are moving, sternocleidomastoids, scalenes, those are the muscles that do, you know, head flexion and extension. There's no swallow muscles involved. Swallow muscles are not, our muscles are not activated when you squeeze on them or push on them. I can squeeze my arm and bicep until I break my arm in half, but my bicep's never going to contract. So using a ball pushing against a ball with my SCMs and scalenes, how is that supposed to help anything related to swallowing? But because there was this article published that says SCMG signals went up, we went from it makes a bigger signal to now it cures dysphagia.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's because it's an easy button.
Well, and unfortunately, I've seen that with a lot of things where there's a simple concept, and I'll just say it's a simple concept for ease of discussion, and it gets generalized to the population and gets generalized to other disorders and generalized to other issues and things going on without the evidence to support
it. Right, because when you don't understand anatomy and physiology, so you don't understand what muscles are engaged, you don't understand the principles of overload and specificity, you know, neuroplasticity, motor learning, exercise, when you don't understand these principles, it's easy to take a sell of goods and just go run with it. Because it's an easy button.
Yeah.
But then if you know all of those things and you sit and say, but does this make sense? All of a sudden it becomes much more difficult to just run forward with it.
So how do we get people, clinicians, to seek that foundational knowledge if they don't have it? Like what do you think is going to inspire people to want to learn that basic foundational knowledge?
If I had to answer that question, I wouldn't be sitting here with you. I'd be ruling the world, right? What I hope is that there are enough people out there saying, you know, the best we have, particularly in dysphagia, which is my area that, you know, this is the area that I can speak to, the very best we have is very weak evidence for anything that we do. If we could grasp onto that, that there aren't answers in the research. Even though I love research, the answers aren't there. No matter how hard you dig and how much you read. And when you realize that the answers aren't there, then you have to start finding where the answers are. Mm-hmm. And the answers are learning this foundational information and applying this information. And it makes it so much more exciting than opening a recipe book, because then you're engaged with your brain, mm-hmm. and then you can engage with your patient and you're really thinking through things rather than just marking the day.
Right. Well, and you know, it's funny you say that, because there are definitely times when I am working on something and I'm checking off the boxes. But when it comes to research, that question comes up because people think everything, they're like, where's the research that shows it? Well, unfortunately, we don't have much research. And, you know, it's developing and people are doing research, but research is very constricted. And I don't think people sometimes realize what goes into the research study and how controlled it is.
Yeah. And therefore, it's not real world.
Yeah, it's not real world and it can't be generalized.
Again, it's that foundational information.
The foundational information and knowing what questions to ask. And I think that's where a big issue comes in, is people, they have their patient, but they don't know where to start, or they don't know what question to ask in order to put it in the right frame for that particular patient, for their diagnosis and what they're going to do. So,
yeah, the ability to ask questions. So when you read work, so some of my favorite works about critical thinking are Paul and Elder have a really awesome book on critical thinking. And then Adam Grant has a great book called Think Again, and it's about thinking about how you're thinking. Metacognition. There's another great book called The Death of Expertise. Tom Nichols. those are my kind of my three go-tos that really keep me energized about thinking and critically thinking. And all of them talk about that the foundation for critical thinking is a strong knowledge base. I think that when you have that knowledge base, that questions are come very easily and questions are not threatening. So those are the two, those are two really key components, like being able to take questions and have your knowledge base challenged is really important. And then being able to know how to ask the right questions because you have this strong knowledge base is the other important thing. So,
well, and I'm going to add one onto your list with the two type of questions, because I think that sometimes people are afraid to ask a question. So we have to get over that fear too.
Yeah.
And know that it's okay to ask. If we don't know, it's okay to say you don't know and to ask the questions.
I love it.
So you not saying that when we say, like, learn these things.
No.
It's ask the questions.
Ask them, yeah, and be open to questions. I love it when people ask me questions because, one, it's telling me they're thinking, and two, it makes me
makes
think.
Makes you think, yep.
Right?
Yep.
And it's like, well, why did I say that? Well, what do I know about that?
And what's ironic with that is, as communication experts, speech-language pathologists, if we go back to our training and we think about teaching kids language skills, there's the turn-taking. And the whole idea of turn-taking is, because if you just say yes, no, that is a conversation stopper. You know, if it's the it's actually the dialogue and the questions that get to the answers, because that's what keeps the conversation going.
When you start reading about Socratic teaching, the worst thing that you can do is give an answer that doesn't require a question, because it stops the thinking process, it stops the thought process. You know, so you always want to be giving information that leads to another question.
Well, and I will sometimes ask a question instead of giving the answer in order to try and draw the thinking out.
Right. I never think I have all the answers. I have very few answers, to be honest with you. But I have lots of questions. And I can tell you all the things that don't make sense, that I have a real hard time telling you things that do make sense. And people will say, well, you're always, you know, well, tell me what to do. You know, you're always telling me what not to do. If I knew what to do, I'd write a book. And I'd sell it, and I'd be a millionaire, right?
Yes.
The reality is, we need to get into a place where we all realize we don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will actually start thinking more rather than start just doing.
Well, and I'm going to circle this back around, because we were talking about the research. And one of the problems, since the research does not provide all the answers, that's really why we have to have that foundational knowledge and the underpinnings, so that we can piece it all together and know better how to apply it to our patients and how to move forward with them, make the plan, depending on what we find with our diagnostics, what that treatment plan might be. It's the links between all of those pieces that help us get there.
And that's what makes us pathologists and not technicians. You know,
yes.
Want to be the speech pathologist. We want to tell people that we're the expert in our building. I read that all the time. Well, you're the expert in your building. Well, that's a whole nother question. Please read The Death of Expertise. By Tom Nichols, and you realize how few people are actually experts and what an expert really is. No, I took a 3-hour class and I might know more than you know or than the person I'm talking to knows, but by no stretch of the imagination am I the expert.
And we have to know what questions to ask, when to ask them, and
be comfortable. It's okay not to know.
Yes.
It's okay. Yeah. And I think that's one of the other things that will help, you know, could help drive this along, is for people to be comfortable in the unknown. We feel like we have to know the answers. We feel like we have to be able to respond. And it's like, just tell them we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that does come up because you mentioned productivity, and sometimes another barrier or issue that people face is they get pushed into seeing a patient that is an area they're not familiar with or not comfortable with, but they're being told, see them anyway. And you mentioned our scope of practice. It's within our scope of practice and in our code of ethics that we aren't supposed to provide services when we're not competent in that area. We should refer them. But I do know, you know, people face those from their, depending on their setting, from their managers or their DORs and all that, you know, you have to see this patient.
And I'm not sure, you know, and I know that there is a lot of that, and I'm not naive by any stretch of the imagination that there is a lot of that. But I will also tell you from personal experience, I know in my very last job where I did work supervising other people, which I was a regional manager of a nursing at a nursing home company, and I brought in a mobile imaging company to say, we're not going to be treating folks unless they have confirmed dysphagia and they give us their consent. Mm-hmm. These are the two foundational pieces that we have to do before we treat people. Because I was a regional manager and it was an in-house therapy program, the administrators gave me no pushback because I was at a regional level. It was the SLPs who gave me all the pushback. I hear people say all the time, my company makes me do this, my company makes me do that. I went in and tried to give them clinical underpinnings to support them to say, we're not gonna do bad practice anymore. We're gonna justify what we do. It was the SLPs who gave me the most pushback, and some of them actually quit because I said, you can't treat this person without imaging. And they were saying, well, you don't trust me in my clinical judgment. I don't trust my own clinical judgment. So no, I'm not gonna trust yours.
Well, there's that tried and true phrase everybody says, we do not have x-ray vision.
Right.
So we have no way of knowing, you know, what's going on without the imaging. I mean, we really,
right.
But
I think
don't.
That, back to your point, is I think that a lot of times we find ourselves in situations because we don't ask questions and we don't push back and we don't advocate in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, not everyone, I get it, not everyone. I know people who've lost their jobs because they've advocated for their patients. And so there are those situations. But I think that we could get a lot farther with questioning and advocating than we are now.
I would agree with that for sure. And I think that if we learn, and maybe that's where we need to start, is how to ask a question. Because we're talking about critical thinking, we need the underpinnings, we need that foundational knowledge to help build that information to help us then formulate the question.
Great, that would be
but
a great discussion.
I think that would be a really good discussion on how do you ask a question, because that questions need a certain format and a certain focus, and they need to be formulated a certain way to really get at what you're trying to get
right.
at.
Right, and there's in that book, Critical Thinking, by Paul and Elder, there's some great advice, great information about how to formulate questions depending on what information you're looking for.
Yes.
And how, and it's based on Bloom's taxonomy. And it's really good stuff. And let's talk about it someday. But today, for the people listening, know that you can find it in that book.
No, that's great. What's the book again? Do you mind?
It's Critical Thinking by Paul and Elder.
Question formulation is, I think, a piece of the puzzle with the critical thinking, is knowing how to ask a question. Did we have any questions from the audience?
No, I have lots of questions. But you started out talking about curriculum, and just to sort of recircle, and see if come full circle, I guess, about what it is that, what we need. And one of the things that I constantly am thinking about as a professor is foundations, and I fight tooth and nail to try to change the curriculum within our system, and I get a ton of pushback. And another sort of weakness I feel like, at least from a professor's point of view, is textbooks, especially in the area of dysphagia. They're antiquated and old. And they're teaching old things that, that aren't necessarily forward-thinking and really sort of bringing forward what we already know in the literature. So I always feel like textbooks are probably around, 10 years behind.
Well, the other problem with textbooks is they're trying to squelch questions. They're trying to provide answers rather than trying to generate questions. And that's back to this whole thing about, it's more important for to have questions than it is to have answers, really, And I think that's the whole niche of the textbook industry, is to provide answers rather than to generate questions.
I know part of the roadblock there is how long it takes to get a book out. It's sort of like doing research with all the the criteria, and then to get a book out, it takes so long to get it through all the stages of development. But I'm not going to name the book, but when I was teaching, I was looking for a new book for a course. I won't even say the course because that might give away the book. But I was looking for a new text, and it was a brand new one off the presses. This was in 2012. And I was all excited, got the book in as a preview. We can get the desk copy. The most recent reference in it was 1998.
And this was 2012.
And that was a 2012 textbook.
So 14 years.
14 years. And I was like, oh, I was like, that won't work. And I didn't use that text because it was already, it was so outdated.
And that's a problem that people don't realize with textbooks is that, and it's not the author's fault. It's just the process is so long that by the time it gets to you, that it's really outdated. And I know people who are still using Jerry Logan's 1983 textbook for swallowing.
That's good information.
And I appreciate who she was and what she offered. But if, well.
But we've learned a lot since then.
Well, and I say we've learned a lot, but I'm going to tell you one more fun story.
Okay.
So I just spoke at a national, at a state level convention recently. And as part of that, I realized that next year will be the 50th anniversary of the first publication of, from a speech pathologist about swallowing.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so we're the, like 50 years, right? And so I went back to that first publication. And mind you, there was no background to this, right? The story, the real story is that a neurologist came to George Larson, who was a speech pathologist in a VA center in Washington State, and said, you study head and neck stuff, muscles and nerves. You should be able to do something. And I, if the people can't see, I have air quotes, do something about these people with swallowing problems. And so he started, air quotes again, doing something.
I think, do we have another question from the audience?
Well,
speaking
sure
of questions?
I'm not sure it's a question, but I just sort of, just again.
Oh, even a comment.
Just yeah. Comments. Just sort of following up with that, you know, where, you know, people aren't asking questions and those kind of things. I am concerned that clinicians aren't privy to the research. And you guys had talked a little bit about research, and you said that it's important, but foundations are important, and that's true. But research is important.
Yes, it is.
And I just want to make sure that we make that clear.
No, yes, and I'm sorry if we came across saying it's not important.
That's the reason why I'm bringing it up.
I'm glad you are.
I want to make sure that all of us are on that
same page. I love research.
Right, and
I'm a huge consumer of research because it's building that knowledge base.
Research is essential.
Right.
It is.
And whether it's good research or bad research, it's still building that knowledge base to help me understand, well, this is where people's understanding is. If it's bad research, well, look at the weakness and understanding that we have. And if it's good research, to add to my base of taking this forward.
And part of the critical thinking is the ability to understand what makes good research and what makes bad research. Because there is research out there that's not that great. And then there's research out there that changes our practices because
Absolutely.
It finds such,
right.
one, you know, it
Absolutely.
Really provides great new information, or even maybe it supports old information, but it provides support for what we're going to do.
Forward,
a pathway,
right.
yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's,
yeah.
the research is actually the underpinning to the foundational knowledge. Like it's sort of, I don't know which one.
Yeah.
Oh, which way you
they
do
build
it.
On
maybe
each
you
other.
Need the foundational knowledge to understand the research.
I
so
think
maybe
so.
The foundational
I think
knowledge
so.
And then the research. It's necessary, and that's why I said we need all the pieces and a way and an understanding and critical thinking of how to bring the pieces
right.
together. How to use the research, how to ask the questions, and then how to make the plan.
Right. Ask the questions. See, it just keeps going back to you have that knowledge base to ask the right questions mm-hmm. so that when someone publishes something that makes no sense, you can say, that makes no sense. You
I think
know.
That students, though, and just from a student perspective, they say, well, I don't know the questions to ask. And
yes.
I think that that's sort of maybe where you guys are going with this, and I would support that. I'm just thinking that at least for young clinicians that are listening to this, just to give them, again, that opportunity, you know, even from somebody that's in the academia, and then you guys being experts in the field to say it's okay, like you were saying, okay to ask the questions, and it's okay to be consciously incompetent, right? So many times I feel like students, or not even students, well, students, yes, they start this way, but as young professionals, they make comments or they think that they're supposed to know everything when they graduate from graduate school.
No
and
no
they
way.
Absolutely will never know.
30 years in, I still don't.
Exactly.
Know.
So I feel like that's something, too, to just sort of put it out there that it's okay to ask questions and that it's okay to be consciously incompetent and to really understand that they constantly need to be learning and that you're not going to know everything right out of the gate
yeah.
as a graduate. You know,
I'm glad as a listener that you've picked up on some probably some weaknesses in what we were how we
yeah.
were sending some information, because the whole idea behind this, and I'll let Ed speak after and kind of bring it all to a close, but the idea was critical thinking and speech-language pathology, where we currently are, the need for it, and how we can move everybody forward and improve it. And it's, and I'm glad because you've brought in, and we want to emphasize research is very important and is necessary in order to develop these skills. And the foundational knowledge aspects that we discussed, and being able to ask a question, and like you were talking about students, and whether it's a student, a new professional, or those of us that have been in the career for decades.
Yeah, and to, and that's part of critical thinking that I hope that we're teaching is, and I think of an example, I just worked again with this group of students who were demonstrating a IOPI, you know, which is my the device I represent. And I said, so is using IOPI an exercise? Because I knew that they had already read the Carnegie 2013, What is the Usual Care in Dysphagia Management in the United States? And one of the things that she says is, in the 254 clinicians that were surveyed, only 13% of what they were doing was exercise-based. And so I knew the students had read that, and I said, so does this IOPI meet the definition of an exercise? You know, and that's exactly what happened.
Silence.
And I said, so I know you read this article. What criteria did she use to decide if something was an exercise or not? What is an exercise? What makes something an exercise versus not an exercise? Crickets. And so I explained, this is the criteria. These are exercise principles. So these are the exercises. But it's, again, we just breeze over these things. And we don't even realize that we need to ask a question. And so it's okay to take a breath and sit down and not just have to rush through reading something, but think. That's where critical thinking begins, when we realize it's not about, and that's what I would say in summary, it's not about the task, it's about the learning process. Mm-hmm. And so stop doing the tasks, put down the tasks, and pick up and be excited about learning.
I think that is a really nice way to conclude our discussion, because you're right, that kind of brings everything back around to the critical thinking.
Been great fun. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate
thank you.
It.
I appreciate your time. Thank so excited. You. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast. And click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.